You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Recording from my office in beautiful Marietta, Georgia, you are listening to the Think Inclusive Podcast, Episode 21. Today, we have Paula Kluth, nationally recognized author and speaker on the topic of inclusive education and autism. We talk about her latest book, Universal Design Daily, and how educators can learn to plan for all students by changing their mindset. After the podcast, please visit patreon.com/thinkinclusivepodcast where you can support our goal to bring you in-depth interviews with inclusive education and community advocacy thought leaders. Also, you can help other people find us by giving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to the Think Inclusive Podcast. So without further ado, here is the interview. It's been a few years since we've talked on the phone. This is really exciting. Thank you for doing this. So what I'm going to do?
Yeah, thank you for having me. I can't believe that it's been a couple of years because I'm always reading everything that you are posting and writing. So it feels like it was just yesterday. But I'm so glad to be back with you, Tim. That's great.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's see what. I wanted to talk about a few things. One about the Universal Design Daily, but I have a few more questions. I know we didn't talk about it beforehand, but I was actually looking I was looking at the questions I asked you. I believe it was like, I want to say almost three or four years ago. Gosh, I can't believe it's been that long. But because we talked about your book, Don't We Already Do Inclusion? And we talked about reverse inclusion, and we talked about families taking their students from public schools and putting them in private schools. But I guess the first thing I wanted to ask was, what is kind of new in your world? Because I know that you have Universal Design Daily, the book, but what else is kind of new for you that you'd like to talk about?
Well, this has, I mean, really, the last time we spoke, I was kind of returning to my roots. Mm-hmm. And you're right, when Don't Worry to Do Inclusion had just come out. So I was kind of going back and talking more broadly about inclusive education. And, you know, I was kind of at a point in my career where when I was talking to folks, I was making some assumptions that, you know, we were on the same page and, you know, we have this commitment to inclusive education, but started to realize that, you know, there's a big difference about, first of all, how people interpreted it, the language of inclusive education, you know, there's semantic differences and the different commitment philosophically from place to place. And I thought, you know, it's time to go back and just revisit, you know, the energy that I felt that, you know, that existed back, you know, in the 80s when it was newer to folks. when we saw more, more folks understanding inclusion for the first time, when people were a little bit, you know, bright eyed about it. And so I wanted to go back and just say, you know, we're kind of, what was like a, you know, Nike, there is no finish line. I mean, you know, that we're never done. That was sort of the point of that book, that there's always something in our model that we can revive, not just because, not just because it's been a while since the initial research around it, but I felt like technology changes, our social models change, you know, our attitudes evolve, because of things like UDL and co-teaching evolving, we have new practices. So I just thought it was time for a little oxygen. So that, I spent a couple of years doing a lot of work in that area, but of course what goes around comes around. So in trying to sort of breathe some life into those conversations, of course, you know, UDL was really gaining a lot of momentum, and in a lot of schools I personally was working in, co-teaching was really blossoming. So in other words, the folks that were making big strides in inclusive education, you know, I was at that point in the conversation once again, which is, okay, tell us how to do this in the most practical ways. And you know, once after spending a couple of years in that world of sort of philosophy and the beliefs around inclusion, it was kind of time to you know, move on to some of these other projects where I got to talk to folks and spend a little bit of time looking at the latest research and latest practices in curriculum and in instruction and in support. And so it's kind of just been a nice, a nice path in the last couple of years. And still going back and forth in those areas. But you know, I find that a lot of the places that I've been working with, especially those in long term, you know, I did find that the shot in the arm around inclusion was really helpful. But they definitely want to then take the next steps, and they want to evolve in how they think about designing instruction. They want to think about human resources. And I was interested in going back to the books on those things, too, because you know, a lot has changed. Talking about UDL, so much has changed in the field just in my, well, I'll say short time, but since the 80s when I started studying it. I mean, think of how many models that we've seen, how different kinds of language that's been used, personalized instruction, different curricular adaptations, differentiated instruction, universal design. So there's plenty to, you know, even for folks that have been doing this work for a while, there's plenty to take a look at in a new way.
So I think that, you know, in talking about the book and the reason why you wrote the book, help me made it. So like, if you talk to me as if I was a teacher that that my administrators and, you know, my instructional support specialists are saying, hey, we really want you to utilize Universal Design for Learning in your lesson plans, and, you know, in your co-teaching model. And we'd love for it to, when we go through and see your teaching, this is what we want to see. Explain to me, you know, well, what is it? What exactly is UDL, and what am I supposed to do with this framework?
Well, it's a great question, because I too find that it can be very confusing, especially if you come from, you know, you knew about differentiation, and you just had to remember a couple of different categories, and there weren't these, many different ways of understanding principles and checkpoints and things like that. With UDL, however, I think the reason why a lot of schools are attracted to it, and why I'm attracted to it in many ways, is because you're dealing with the same idea. Truly, I think what's confusing to teachers is they think, well, I was already doing a lot of these things. Why are you now taking this and giving it a different house and giving it a different name and, providing a new lens? And the couple of reasons for that. The first is that, and I'll say I kind of, you know, was reluctant to sort of remodel and reshape the way I was talking and thinking. But I think the three things that might be attracting a lot of administrators are, number one, As opposed to some of the other models, there is this nice evolution and focus around thinking about technology, not as a set of materials, but as a way of thinking. So it's not to say that those examples and that focus wasn't in previous models. If you pick up any, you know, anything on differentiation, you're going to find these kinds of examples. But I think that the origin of UDL and the initial thrust came a lot out of looking at what technology could do for people in leveling the playing field and providing opportunities and just having access be the norm, that a lot of it grew out of that. So that's number one, is that there's more of a focus there. The second thing that I think made people excited about UDL was that, well, I'll speak for myself, is the word universal itself. I'm not sure this is always happening in practice, but the idea that we could hold this higher standard and say, this is really about all kids. And one of the things I say when I'm presenting is, if you are using UDL and you don't notice that there is a wider range of learners in your school or classroom or district, you know, because of this, then we're really, it really flies in the face, I think, of the intention of a model like this. It's about universal. That means everybody. So we should, the focus, I think, the intention here on all students, I think, is really important. And the third piece, I think, that's interesting and maybe why it's getting a lot of attention from folks, maybe, you know, versus some previous models, is that it takes into account a lot about the learner and the learner as an agent. Again, it's not to say that other methods that we have, you know, celebrated in a differentiation model or in a curricular adaptations model didn't you know, have that language or didn't have those examples. But there's a lot of, you know, centering on student engagement and students setting their own goals and the growth mindset. And we're really thinking about these partnerships in new ways. So again, those elements might have been in other models, but they're really central in universal design. So that's the first part. That's, I think, why people are excited. The second part, which is what is universal design? Well, it's just like some of those other models that I mentioned. It's a way of designing curriculum, instruction, assessment in a way that is going to be supportive of all learners, that's going to accommodate variability and uniqueness and differences from the ground up. So the criticism, I think, if you can use that word, of differentiation, was it was additive or it was retrofit. So that you kind of did the lesson and then you say, oh, Tim needs something different and Paula really needs some support there. So the idea here, I think many, many things teachers did in the name of differentiation and many authors, and myself in that wrote about differentiation, had those, you know, ways of being in mind. Mm-hmm. But universal design, with its very, you know, initial language, focused on this idea that design, this was from the ground up. And you know, a lot of folks may know this already, but the language of universal design comes out of architecture, and it's that idea that, you know, you wouldn't, have to go and retrofit some part of the building, but you would build those ramps and in a way that's right into the design, and it's, you know, it's a beautiful part of the design, and everybody can use it, and there are options for all, but it's not something that we have to add in or change up because of one or two individuals or percent. Mm-hmm. So it focuses, universal design focuses on these three areas, and you'll see overlap, right, from other models. So different folks will call these categories something different, but this one focuses on something called engagement, which is about not, it sounds like it's something that we do to kids, but a lot of the strategies that have been targeted engagement are also things that kids would do. Again, that sense of agency or pursuing their own interests. It's about making sure that there's relevance, cultural relevance, personal relevance. What about motivation? Are they challenged? That's engagement. And you're going to provide multiple methods, maybe not in every lesson, but throughout the days, the weeks, the months, and the year. And then you're going to look for multiple methods of action and expression. And that's really about how we are going to teach and support all kinds of ways of showing what you know so that students can demonstrate learning in lots of different ways. They can demonstrate their understanding. We've seen that language before, for sure. This is, you know, other ways of thinking about that, of labeling it, I should say. And then finally, there's these multiple methods of representation. So that's giving students lots of ways of acquiring information and knowledge so that we're going to make sure that if we're providing, we're teaching a lesson, that there's lots of ways for kids to get that. There may be physical models. They may be doing a field trip, a virtual field trip. They could read about. So that's kind of saying, like, you know, everything from having lots of different kinds of materials to making sure that through the use of technology, for example, kids can, you know, use e-readers to enlarge text so that the ways in which they're getting the content or information is appropriate for them. So when you hear those three categories, you know, a lot of teachers feel overwhelmed. It seems like a lot, but in some ways, that's only three compared to other models and differentiation throughout the years that I've had 8 or 9 different variables to keep in mind. So, you know, it's just, I think it's just, any of these models and the evolution of these models is an attempt to, I think, inspire us to think about the possibilities for students. But also a way, so in other words, here's all the things that we might do to make a home for kids. But I think it's also, I think the other reason our models evolve is to everyone's attempt to say, how can I phrase this in a way that is elegant in its simplicity? And I think it's everyone's attempt to say, how do we take what we know today and make that, think about universal design. How do we do this in a way that's accessible for folks? So I think by breaking it down to these three categories, granted, there's a lot of, what the folks at CAST, the materials they put out for us, I mean, there's a lot sort of under each one of those to consider. But I think those three categories are an attempt to say, hey, these are the three things we want you to keep mindful around. And so if throughout with your co-teaching partners, with your students, with, you know, in your lesson planning, when I'm coming in to observe you as your administrator, as you asked, what kind of language do I have to have and concepts should I have some command of, what I would say is, start with trying to get a grasp on the differences in those three principles. And then secondly, start to understand that you're already doing this. And just start to shake out, okay, of the things I'm doing, where do they fit in this model? And in that model, which of those areas may I need more study around? Which of those areas, contain strategies that I don't know much about? How can I keep adding to my my knowledge base around these? So it does provide space for us to brainstorm and collaborate, provides kind of a common language for us as collaborative partners. But I do think it can be a lot. But I always say, just start small, start with the principles themselves, and then fill in and understand what you're already doing and how it fits in. And I think that can help folks take next steps and start to understand this is not reinventing the wheel. You know how to do this. It might be a different way of talking, and it might be help you provide a framework to learn some new things.
So I have a couple different questions from what you said. The first would be, what would be the main pushback that you get if you do from teachers when you are explaining UDL and these principles, and kind of, is it more, I'm already doing this, why do I need to do this? Or is it more, I don't know how specifically to do this, can you tell me how specifically to do it? Or is it something else that you get as pushback?
I think all of that.
Okay.
it's like there's some sense of overwhelm. There's some confusion about the model. I think the first thing is so much that there's so much material out there. And again, so many different ways that I've heard many different explanations of what it is and how to start. So I always say I always start by saying, let's just catalog, let's just get you that firm grasp on these three principles. Do you have a sense of that? Mm-hmm. And then we're going to use that as a way to understand your units and then your lessons. So in these lessons, you know, are there multiple ways for students to get that content? Do students have multiple ways, not just within lessons, but let's also look broadly across the days, the weeks, the months, and the year to see how many, you know, let's just collect some strategies. Let's start to plug in what you have. And then, I, you know, after that, when I get the sense of, like, I don't know where to start, I don't know what else to do, especially for those that think they're not doing it, I say, just pick one, you know, start with something. You might just start by saying, you know, I'm going to add in some more open-ended questions as a way to frame units. Or start by maybe taking one unit and providing a wider range of learning materials. Or maybe you're going to introduce a few new tech tools. Maybe you haven't had kids blogging before. You haven't introduced speech recognition software, something like that. Maybe you're going to co-teach with somebody new. That's a really powerful strategy. Maybe you're going to start by varying your student groupings, giving some choices, you know, some new assessment tools. So when we put it that way, that's all things, you know, teachers say, oh yeah, well, I guess I could do that. Oh yeah, I could, you know, maybe try a new assessment tool.
Right.
So just trying to break it down to, this is the kind of stuff you've always done. Let's just look at, as I said, with those three different principles, sometimes it helps to just kind of, recategorize a little bit of what they're already doing. And then, you know, just pick some place to get going. One of the things that, you know, I suggest often in that place of overwhelm is to give, you know, start with a single lesson and give it a makeover. It's kind of a hack, right? So, you know, you take one lesson, maybe with a partner, and just say, okay, is this rigorous enough? And this is actually one of the ideas from the book, and I use this a lot with teachers, is we just start with, okay, let's look at this, and, you know, let's look at things like, is it rigorous enough? Is it accessible? Is it interesting? Is it, you know, the activities varied? Are there several ways for students to learn? Or how many ways are there for students to show what they know? We just start with just one lesson and having them identify, oh, yeah, right, this one actually looks pretty good. And that's actually another idea is, you know, don't fix it if it ain't broke. I mean, sometimes,
right,
you know, you have a really elegantly simple lesson and it's already there. And I think that can be helpful for teachers, too, is just to look at this and say, oh, yeah, that's actually, you know, well done. And that's why I say it's about not just looking at lessons and units, but it's also about looking at the course of the year. So a lot of teachers will say, oh, I love when I do that simulation lesson. And I ask, what's your favorite lesson? What are kids like? And then I say, maybe for you, it's just about increasing, you know, the frequency of some of the things that you know really work well. And, you know, that kids really respond to. So it may not be about reinventing the wheel. It's about maybe thinking about the menu or even the rhythm of the lessons from week to week and increasing the good stuff there. And also just looking for feedback from folks. So it might be asking students to give you some feedback. If you have a teaching partner, doing some observing back and forth about what's working. And then just kind of build a little bit slowly. But, you know, when I was writing the book, I found myself, I was overwhelmed with all the sort of narrative accounts of UDL. So that's why it's like, you know, 365 ideas, and you can just open it and pick something and say, okay, this is an engagement idea. I think I'll pick this. And because if I felt that much overwhelmed with getting started, I thought other people will too. So that's one of the things I tell folks is, like, I'll open a page and pick something and just try it. You don't have to keep using it, but just try it. And you can use any number of resources for that. You can open a blog, you can go on Twitter, try something in an area that you feel is, you know, maybe an area that you is a growth area for you.
Right. Yeah.
You don't have to keep it. You can go back.
You sort of answered my second question in that was what are some specific strategies, maybe from even the book, that can kind of refocus you. And I think you made a really good point, if I heard you correctly, that sometimes you know, we know what works, we know what keeps the students engaged, but we almost don't want to use it all the time because we feel like, they're going to get used to this, or they're going to get satiated on it, or whatever. But I think that another way to think about it is, yes, you actually do know what your kids like and what your students like, and you can vary the way that you represent the material, like you said, using that UDL principle, and it's okay to have fun. It's okay.
It's necessary, because we know that laughter releases endorphins. We know that movement, interaction, that's part of that engagement. It's okay, and it's actually really good for you, and it's really good for them. That kids aren't. It's not good. It's not healthy. It's not even physically healthy for kids to be sitting and getting for long periods of time. And so we know that, that's why a lot of these engagement strategies have to do with kids as agent, kids making things, kids asking questions, kids in charge, student-centered, fill in the blank, right? So project-based instruction, service learning, all that good stuff, and things like you said, like bringing in humor and figuring out what kids find, what's novelty and joy. All those things are an important part, especially of that engagement piece. And it's important. And like I said, it's a teacher. Sometimes, it is. I think it's like, it can't be, can't be a circus every day. And it doesn't necessarily have to be every day, that you've got three plates twirling in the air. But over the course of the days, the weeks, the months, and the year, students should be able to count on you for learning experiences that do rise up to meet them, so to speak, and that they should, that classroom should be a place of, exploration, and there should be smiles, and there should be laughter, and there should be human connection. All of those things are good, not just for a healthy community, but those things are good for learning. And the other thing I think that's important about, and again, I think that focus on engagement here versus like process or content, which are more, again, I love those other, I'm not saying this is necessarily, for some teachers that the language that's the most inspiring and helpful, but I like that language of engagement because I think it helps us to think about those things in ways maybe other models didn't as well. Mm-hmm. But the other thing I would say about, repeating things is that, you want, two things. I always say you want repetition, because when you have some repetition, whether it's every Friday we have this kind of collaborative exercise, we always kick off Monday with morning meetings, or on Wednesdays I always infuse a lot of group work, or whatever those patterns are helpful for kids, right? Because they know there's some expectation there that helps with routine and ritual. Helps a lot of our kids, we know, and also I think helps us too with things like planning and collaboration. So if you're the speech path and you know that we do a lot of collaborative work on Wednesdays, that's like, I don't have a lot of time scheduled. I don't have normally scheduled time in your classroom on Wednesdays, but if anything opens up, I know to go to your classroom because kids are working and I can easily work with students on lots of different goals because I know that it's not teacher directed. So I love that. And the other thing that I like about patterns is that I think it's great for co-teaching partners. It becomes a shorthand, right? So like, this is how we always do social studies centers to kick off social studies stations to kick off every new unit. So when we start to plan together, that's already in the books. We already kind of know what we usually do with those stations. We usually know which teacher is going to facilitate. So it starts to build in some really nice shorthand there. But having said that, when you have, whether it's this book or blogs or Twitter or whatever you're using for your ideas, when you then have some of these other resources, now you've got your patterns down, then you can jazz it up and feel like, okay, I'm already using a lot of different things. I know what kids like. Now I realize, okay, we've been doing that same collaborative structure every Friday. Now that I feel like there's a nice variation across the days, let's now look and try a different collaborative structure on Fridays. Mm-hmm. Or if we're still going to kick off with our stations and you usually facilitate, why don't I do that now? Or why don't we take out the station where kids were doing writing in this way and have them do something collaborative? So, you know, once you kind of stabilize there, and then you can start with that, you know, trying something different, switching some things out and building your repertoire. Because I don't expect that every lesson you've got 100 ways, you know, for students to, you know, engagement strategies or methods of action or methods of representation. But across the days, the weeks, the months, and the year, within even those patterns, you want to make sure that there are lots of ways for kids to show what they know, lots of ways for kids to understand the content, lots of ways for them to engage and be motivated. So that, I think, is kind of a balancing act, right? So that there's some... Right. What's the word I want? There's an element of ritual and predictability is what I want. But then there's also that I can count on you for some of this novelty too, because we know that that's really helpful. It's a really helpful for students, and it's a learning state. A novelty is that you know, supports students' attention and is very motivating. So it's, you know, kind of just that back and forth of making sure that we have a little bit of both.
Right. Yeah. We want predictability and pattern, but that also can become pretty stale. And then also,
That's right. Also
this idea of compliance. I went to an autism conference here in Georgia just recently, and I was so struck by what one of the speakers said, and her name is Emily Rubin. I don't know if you're familiar with her,
but yeah, I do know her.
She said something, paraphrasing, that a well-behaved child does not equal a fully engaged child. And I loved that, because for many of our teachers, compliance or a well-behaved class is very important. And it is so important that that is, you know, they have their classroom management system, and they have their rewards, and they have their, you know, their token system, their token economy, and they have the marbles in the jar and all that stuff. And that's all great. And I'm not saying that that is necessarily bad. But the focus is on, let's get a routine. Let's get everything structured,
right,
so that my classroom is a well-oiled machine, as opposed to, are my kids having fun? Are they engaged? Are they learning? The most important piece of that. And I think that that is so important when you're talking about universal design for learning, is that really is the biggest piece of it. And if your kids aren't, if your students don't like you, and I'm not saying that you should be friends with your students, but if they don't like you, right, and they don't love learning and love their friends and love coming to school, then they have no motivation or self, there's no intrinsic value to learning. So having all of that together, it doesn't even matter what setting it is. It could be co-teaching, it could be even in a special day class or a self-contained classroom, it could be in a small group room. Anytime you have a teacher that is invested in the student, in that relationship, I think, you know, that is where magic really happens, and learning really happens. So I really appreciate this conversation, because and I definitely see the I definitely see why administrators and district leaders want to have this conversation with their teachers, because I think they really do see it as the big key to unlocking all the other things, you know, the test scores and all that stuff, because they do see that that is important, and that it is. Because that's just the system that we have set up,
I mean, look at the research coming out about, you know, places that are increasing recess, and because they're just increasing recess, is the only intervention, test scores are going up. That just shows you the difference between, I mean, that's just one small area, but when you look at this misconception that if we get kids in their desks sitting quietly and we teach and talk at them, that's going to have these results, these positive results, when in fact what we know is that students need to move, talk, share, interact, and get intellectually messy, mm-hmm. and that they need to be agents. I mean, one of the things I look at when I've been doing some like walk arounds in schools as part of this, you know, this book. So sometimes I'll, you know, do a little presentation and then I'll go and see lessons. And one of the things I do is I just, in my own head, I'll just walk along a corridor. It doesn't matter, elementary, high school. And I'll say, I wonder, okay, let's just say it's a half an hour into the school day. I wonder in how many classrooms I'll see students doing anything other than sitting in their desks, working quietly. And it's shocking to me. So in every classroom, there'll be some time for that. But it's shocking to me that how many times it's 100% of the classrooms, you know, go past 10 classrooms, everybody's in their seat working quietly. When we actually know that, you know, that students, you know, require to, you know, movement, they need engagement, they need to have their hands on, they need minds on, they need to be solving problems. We should be hearing their voices. I mean, that's a great marker. A lot of the ideas, at, you know, in the engagement section, you know, a principal here, and also in the, you know, the principle not representation, but well, actually, you could talk about it in any one of the principles, I suppose. But and I was trying to say action and expression. We should be giving kids all kinds of ways to interact with materials, interact with each other, have leadership in the classroom. And so I always say one of the good markers, you know, of knowing if you're getting there is to sort of start to evaluate how much of the time are you talking versus how much of the time they're talking. In the course of a week, how many different ways were there for students to learn and or show what they know? So some of those kinds of questions can be really helpful. How many times would you say that students, you know, laughed or were joyful? You kind of alluded to that during a week. Those are really good starting places for thinking about, is this a place, is this a productive learning environment? Because those things are not just nice to have. Those things are central to learning itself. And so when you, and especially when you talk about things like getting kids in their seats and the, you know, marbles in the jar, we know that there are so many benefits now to movement. And I wouldn't say that everything that I've written about engagement is movement oriented, but a lot of what I've written and hear about engagement and a lot of the ideas of, you know, expression are about movement or in some kind of active learning. So for example, some of the benefits of active learning, you know, we know it's good for, we know it's good for health. We know it's good for creativity, especially things like brainstorming. We know it's really helpful for retention. We know it's really good for engagement, staying with the material itself. I mean, it could go on and on. And so the data is there. It's amazing, I think, in some ways, how long it's taking an institution that, you know, I think really cares about, you know, about change and about learning, that it's taking a long time because it's just worse. It's, you know, what schooling is so entrenched in media or in, you know, in books. Like we see, you still see, if you turn on, you know, if you turn on a medical show, they have an operating room that looks like today's operating room. Otherwise people would think that was a ridiculous show. So, it, you know, they show, I think, you know, many of the more, you know, common technologies. But when you see a classroom on TV, it looks like the classroom that we grew up in, right? You don't see cooperative learning. You see the teacher at the, you know, sometimes even it drives me crazy. You'll see the teacher on the chalkboard. I say, no one has a chalkboard anymore.
Exactly.
In other words, there's still this, you know what I'm saying? It's like still this very traditional way of thinking about it. So it's a very hard, you know, for some reason in our profession, it's, even though we know that what's, that the classroom should look very different today than it did before we had this data. Yet, I think there's a real pull, even for newer teachers, because of what you said, Tim. I think because of there's like these reward structures or these old values that are in place, or because people are panicked about testing, even though the irony of that is, you know, if we know that students learn more when they are, in fact, at the center of this, when they are in dialogue, when they are connecting, when they are teaching, then the way to get higher test scores is actually to move away from traditional constellations. So that's sort of the irony. But, you know, you're 100%, you're right. about the compliance for sure.
Yeah, and also what I find too is that teachers are resistant to change because they feel I don't know if offended is the right word, but they like, well, I've been, you know, some of the older, the teachers who've been teaching for a long time, well, I've been doing this for so long this way. Why is it now that I have to change? And then the blame is on the students. So, well, if only they would practice more at home, if only their parents would discipline or follow through, if only, so all of these things, these are big barriers, I think, of the mindset that, well, I don't have to change, it's the students that have to change. And so, and even in, you know, when you think about you know, when you're talking about changing behavior and the applied behavior analysis, right? When we create behavior intervention plans, they aren't for the kid. They're for the teacher.
Right.
You know, this is like, you have to change the environment in order to change someone else's behavior. So you have a certain, you have this environment that fosters a particular kind of behavior out of whoever, and you actually have to change the environment in order to change the behavior. But a lot of times the mindset is, well, if only they would. So that is, right. I think, a really big obstacle. And so it's difficult to kind of, massage that, that idea so that it's not about blame, you know, it's not about blaming teachers because they've been doing it wrong all these years. I think it's about, here is what we know works, and why wouldn't we want to do what works, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, and I think sometimes for some teachers, it may be that, you know, that they're, you know, it's not their style or something. I've had teachers tell me, my gosh, my principal would hit the roof if he saw me, you know, doing some of these things that you're showing me, if they were dancing around, or if they were in playing some of these collaborative games, or if they were engaged in drama. So I don't know if that's actually true, or if it's just a perception of the teacher. So I think there's a lot of things that we're up against in schools. It may be that some teachers were taught in a more traditional way. It could be some that don't feel that they have to support, whether or not that's true, you know, I mean, but they feel that they don't. In other cases, I feel like maybe they don't, they were not quote, raised in that model. So they're not quite sure actually what it looks like. And so that's another challenge. So in the beginning of the book, in the very front part, I have a part about you know, a dozen of the ideas are for PD. So PD for UDL, professional development. And so I have a lot of ideas in there for that very thing you're talking about, because I feel like a lot of folks are like, I don't even know what this looks like. So I, you know, I'm suggesting things like, you know, go and, you know, talk to other folks and, you know, ask to actually, you know, do an observation in your district. Ask, a lot of principals, if you say, here's the problem, but I've got a solution, can I go and see another English teacher that's doing something that you would call UDL? A lot of administrators would be very open to that. Another idea I say is, some people might be aware of the language of pineapple charts, which are kind of this new, I guess, newer to me, but I saw it written about in a great blog called Cult of Pedagogy. And they talked about having this, I think pineapple, because pineapple means friendship, I think. But anyway, there's this chart in the teacher's lounge, and you can find them online. You'll find lots of examples on Pinterest. But you essentially have a schedule in your teacher's lounge, and then anybody that's doing anything innovative. So it's like Tim is going to do some really cool, you know, students are going to be creating, you know, they're going to design their own Rube Goldberg machines. And, you know, I'm a physics teacher, and here are the principles we're going to be looking at. Oh, wow, I'd love to see that. So you just put on there, hey, I'm going to be doing these Rube Goldberg machines all Monday. And so that means if you put it up there, it means anybody can come visit your classroom. Any teacher, any administrator, they don't evaluate you. There's no conversation. It's very informal, but you're just learning from somebody else. or like somebody else that's like, oh, I'm going to actually have students use the 3D printer. I've never even seen that in use in a classroom. What are you going to do with it? So you can put that up. And so it's this way of learning from others in your building that feels maybe less intimidating. And quite frankly, it's way cheaper than going to a conference if you really don't have a lot of resources. Mm-hmm. But so I would say, you know, for those that like they are feeling up against it and doing something new, another idea is and I've written about this before, but having sort of like a UDL fair at your school where everybody brings one thing, just one thing that you're doing. And so maybe like, oh, I've been doing these, like I've been trying, you know, this cool new app. And so I can do a quick demonstration of that, or, hey, we're doing a lot of one teach, one observe in our classroom. And we have a little video clip of that, or we've been using choice boards a lot. And we did a little, you know, we could do a little 5 minutes on that. So that's just another way that if you do feel like whether it's, hey, old dog, new tricks, or whether it's I don't feel the support necessarily and I'm not co-teaching, or maybe it's just that I don't know what it looks like, look for some, you know, customized professional development to get some feeling of, you know, get a grasp on it, but also to feel like, you know, end your isolation and to be a little bit inspired.
Those are fantastic ideas. I think that everyone should get Universal Design for Daily for themselves. get those practical strategies. Is there anything else that you wanted to either talk about or promote while I've got you recording?
You know, one thing that, you know, not only is a promotion, I guess, but also I think will be helpful to people is, let me say one more thing about a PD thing that if I can leave with one thing is, you know, whether you're ending the school year, by the way, I think those folks that teach till mid-June, for example, or late June, the best time to try something new in the classroom, Tim, I don't know if you agree with me, is at the end of the year.
Sure, absolutely.
Well, what's the point, right? Why do that? Because now it's like, you know, they've seen a lot of stuff. Everyone's a little bored. Everyone's a little tired. Go ahead and knock it out. Create, you know, do a cool panel. Try some neat, you know, improv techniques, you know, to work on your metaphors. Or, you know, co-teach with your speech path. You haven't done that before. Like, this is a great time to just, you know, just jazz things up a little bit. And with that, what I would say is consider as a way to kind of get focused after just listening to this podcast is sit down either by yourself or with any partner and just set like a couple of UDL goals for yourself. That can help you feel like here's everything out here I want to do. Okay, but let's just boil it down to a couple things. So you might just say, okay, I'm going to buy, you know, my goal next year is to use a new active learning technique every month next year, or I'm going to co-teach with my reading specialist, you know, by the end of the school year here, or I'm going to teach my classroom paraprofessional about what UDL is so that we're both empowered by this date. I'm going to go to, you know, I'm going to sign up for this workshop or seminar, read the book. So you can just kind of just start to focus maybe just one goal. And if folks listening can maybe think about just a couple of things to start their journey, that might be a good way to do it. But I wanted to say for resources, I've been doing some little short videos. I think I've done like 6 or 7 of them, and they're called Off the Page. And they're basically, people were writing or calling and they're saying, I had one client that I worked with for a long time and they said, can you send us a video of that one thing that you said that one time? And it's like, okay. And then somebody else asked for that. And I'm like, you know, I'll just put them up for anybody. So I have like a YouTube channel now. So it's just my name. And every month I've put one up the last like 6 months or something, but I probably will end up not doing as maybe like every other month. That's probably what I'll end up doing. But they're all of the ideas are just from any book. So I'll just take, you're going to love this kid, or I'll take, you know, 30 days to the Coach Hot Classroom, and I'll just shoot a 5-minute video. And I take one little idea paragraph from a book and I just talk about it. and they're free. You just download them from YouTube, and you can use them in a professional development setting. If you're having a brown bag lunch with your paraprofessionals, if you are presenting to your school board, it's just a little morsel about something related to inclusion. So I've done, I think, three from Universal Design Daily. So whether it's that you're interested in or something else, that's just a free resource that I want people to be able to use to, you know, take the energy of inclusion other places. And a couple of the things that, you know, maybe even be baffling about UDL, check out the videos that are on the YouTube.
Great. Awesome. So they can, the listeners can find you at paulacluth.com, I believe. And then you're on Twitter as well. I think at paulacluth.
Pinterest, Facebook, and I'm a fledgling Instagram user, so don't go there yet.
Okay, all the things.
But I'm trying to work it out. All the things, exactly.
All right, good, good. Well, thanks for your time, and I appreciate you taking time out to speak with us.
Thank you so much, Tim. I really appreciate it. I feel like I just feel like I'm having a coffee with you, so hopefully that's not too casual, because this is the kind of thing all people should get to do, is just have these collegial conversations. So I thank you as well for that opportunity.
That is our show. We would like to thank Paula Cluth for coming on the Think Inclusive podcast. Make sure to follow her on Twitter, Facebook, and as well as paulacluth.com. Follow Think Inclusive on the web at thinkinclusive.us, as well as Twitter, Facebook, Google+, and Instagram. Today's show was produced by myself, talking into USB headphones, a Zoom H1 handy recorder, MacBook Pro, GarageBand, and a Skype account. You can also subscribe to the Think Inclusive podcast via Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, or Podomatic.com, the largest community of independent podcasters on the planet. From Marietta, Georgia, please join us again on the Think Inclusive podcast. Thanks for your time and attention.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.